after what is always promised and delivered as a substantial buffet, may I welcome you all to this meeting with the simple question, is Pakistan the world's most dangerous place? I learnt one lesson today, and that is never come up the steps of this institution with Michael Ankrum, because he might ask you to chair the meeting. And I will be very wary indeed in future. But first a housekeeping note, if I may, relating to the next meeting of the forum. The next lunchtime event will take place next week on Tuesday the 19th of May. The debate is entitled, Is the World Economic Crisis Our Biggest Security Threat? Panelists, Oliver Kam, leader writer for The Times, David Omand, visiting professor at the King's War Studies Department, formerly the first UK security and intelligence coordinator as permanent secretary to the Cabinet Office, and Gideon Rachman, chief foreign affairs commentator for the FT. This will again take place here in the David Lloyd George Room at the club next Tuesday. Turning now to the speakers and the subject, and may I say that, as always, we aim to finish by 2 o'clock. So if I can underline for our speakers 6-7 minutes, so that we do have agreed? So we do have some time for question and answer, and I know that the new Deputy High Commissioner of Pakistan will want to say a few words, and since he has said a few words, I will underline that as well. There is no need for me to stress the importance of Pakistan and in its region. This is recognized by the quality of the team in the new US administration, and obviously potentially a far greater threat to world peace because of the nuclear element, but I anticipate of what our panelists are going to say today, the 3+1 speakers. So let us all defer judgment on this subject until we've heard the 3 speakers and the Deputy High Commissioner. Let me perhaps introduce for ease of reference our 3 speakers briefly. Baroness Faulkner, who is a colleague of mine in the House of Lords. She sits as a Liberal Democrat peer, speaks for her party on the justice matters, was the first Muslim peer for the Liberal Democrats, speaks extensively on public policy issues relating to foreign affairs, counterterrorism and civil liberties, Muslims in the West, multiculturalism and integration. In 2006, she was a fellow at the JFK School of Government in Harvard, dealing with U.S. foreign policy and democracy. She was appointed Chancellor of the University of Northampton in 2008. Born in Pakistan, naturalized UK citizen, elevated to the House of Lords 5 years ago. Farzana Sheikh, Associate Fellow of the Asia Programme at Chatham House, directs the Pakistan Study Group, doctorate at Columbia, lecturer to a research fellowship at Clare Hall in Cambridge, lectured at universities in the UK and worldwide, commented widely on Pakistan for the media here and abroad, and written extensively on this subject. Her new book, Making Sense of Pakistan.
Out in the bookshops.
And she has anticipated what I was going to say. There was going to be a golden plug for your new book.
Of course.
And I'm sure you'll sign for anyone who... And then, finally, Sir Hilary Synod. I did say when we last met in Baghdad, but he tells me it was Basra, specialist in South Asian studies and post-conflict issues at the IISS. Before retiring from the British Diplomatic Service, was the Coalition Provisional Authorities Coordinator for South Iraq from 2003, July 2003, January 2004, dealing with civilian affairs there. 3 years as British High Commissioner in Islamabad, Director for South and Southeast Asian Affairs at the FCO, author of several relevant books. And finally, I will call on Mr. Asif Durrani, Deputy High Commissioner for Pakistan. But we do have a panel with very wide background and diverse experience. And I call first, therefore, the Baroness Faulkner, my colleague, if you would speak for 6.5, 7 minutes. I'll be very ruthless, I promise you.
Thank you, Donald. There is a method to the lineup of speakers. You're going to get the polemical politician's view first, then you're going to get the expert view, and then finally in Sir Hillary you'll get the authoritative view. So you're allowed to sleep through this one, but you'll have to wake up for the other two. Now, the topic is of course a very, very provocative one, but there is more and more, alas, an element of truth in it. You can't have a combination of nuclear weapons, terrorism, poverty, dictatorship, political Islam, and narcotics in the embodiment of one very poorly governed state and not worry about how dangerous it is. I think there are three aspects to it that I want to pull out. One is to do with the governance of the country and how the lack of governance, the increasing instability, is impacting on Pakistanis themselves. A secondary issue is how it will impact on the region, the broader region. And then finally, to what extent will an implosion of Pakistan impact on the rest of the world and principally on the United States and us in the United Kingdom? So how unstable is it? I mean, we had the Prime Minister come back and tell us 2 weeks ago that we needed to formulate or perhaps renew our strategy there, which sort of implied that we were less clear than we had been in our previous formulation of strategy. It was only a few months old the last time it was enunciated. But he did acknowledge that 2,000 Pakistanis were killed last year alone in terrorist attacks and that there were over 60 suicide bombings. We know that the Pakistani army is now deployed in operations against the Taliban in Swat, and figures today suggest very heavy casualties on all sides. In the last few months, the United Nations Office for Refugees has registered nearly a million people as displaced. And this is not actually a reflection of the true figure of displaced, because as we all know from statistics, those who actually register as displaced are numerically significantly smaller normally than those who are made refugees. Terrorism is not just restricted to the Fatah areas. We've seen militant groups take the fight to Islamabad, Lahore, and Karachi, the three major cities of the country. Karachi is particularly vulnerable, with more than 3 million Pashtuns living there. It was the scene of pitched battles between different factions earlier this year, and the mayor of Karachi told the Financial Times recently that he saw his greatest challenge in a city of 14 million people to be the rise of Taliban and Al-Qaeda. I spoke to him less than a year ago, and at that point I asked him to describe what he saw as the great challenges facing the city. And in addition to normal law and order, he described economic growth and development as his greatest challenge. So this is a significant shift. A further feature is the threat to civil society. Under Musharraf, civil society grew and prospered, as did the media, independent media. For the first time now, civil society groups feel cowed by increasing Talibanization. Their developmental work is undoubtedly more difficult, and many have received death threats or threats of one kind or another. And these are groups that are headquarters, including media editors and so on, in the big cities. Turning to Al-Qaeda, the war in Afghanistan has resulted in a displacement effect in terms of movement. The leaders of the Afghan Taliban are undoubtedly operating out of the Fatah areas, the federally administered tribal areas, and Balochistan, both regions which have historic tribal alliances across the other side in Afghanistan. There has also been a displacement effect to Pakistan from insurgents in Iraq and nearer fields, such as Uzbekistan. The role of Saudi Arabia and Iran in supporting sectarian violence in parts of the Fatah has resulted in some 1,500 people being killed in Khurram Agency in Shia-Sunni violence, which all add to the complexity. Now let me turn to the economy. Pakistan is currently in IMF receivership. Its GDP per capita is hovering around $1,000, and inflation is 30%. Foreign investment, which has risen in recent years, is on hold, while investors try to work out how reliable their returns might be. Pakistan's largest donors, the US and the UK, are the least popular with the public. Anti-Americanism and, by extension, anti-British sentiment is rife. Pakistan's other friends in the Middle East are tightening their belts, in any event. So the stakes for all of us are considerably higher than they were in 2007 when the momentum against the military took hold. The waters of democracy in Pakistan always ran in an extremely shallow stream. At this point in time, they'll either dry up or the other outcome, as they will prove to be so turbulent so as to imperil the nation. Fareed Zakaria, in his book The Future of Freedom, suggested that a GDP per capita of around $7,000 was necessary for successful transitions to democracy. Pakistan at under 1,000 and moving in the wrong direction has a long way to go on that count. So what are the prospects for democratic stability? The evidence shows there's still popular support for democracy per se, despite the widespread disillusionment with the Zardari government, which is hovering at about 19% in its approval ratings. The question becomes, to what extent can the government survive? If it falls, prospects are that Mr. Sharif and PML will come back to power. Indeed, the current media reports suggest that the Obama administration is extending its overtures to him. It is not difficult to see where the Sharif government will lead us. We will probably have more stability. The Islamists will give a new Sharif government some time in order to deliver on the promises they have no doubt made. But whether in the end those Islamist promises will be deliverable or not will much depend on the army. So where is the army? At the moment it seems unlikely to step up to the challenge. Should things get worse, I can't see an alternative, but that is some way off at the moment. In either event, we in the West are in for a difficult period ahead. This matters to us because of our regional role in Afghanistan. It matters because we need to keep India on board. It matters because of the nuclear question. And it matters because of our own domestic lobby comprising significant numbers of the Pakistani diaspora. In the immediate term, we'll need to stabilise the situation through counterinsurgency assistance, developing the police, the frontier force, and so on, and long-awaited development aid. In the longer term, Pakistan needs a new constitutional settlement, and that will be a significant challenge. If we fail at both, we'll need to think through a strategy of containment in terms of while we give the Pakistanis time to work out what they themselves must do. Whether that working out comes through an Algeria-style, longish and costly in terms of human life, civil war, or whether it comes through muddling through with the army back in power, one can't predict. I think I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman, and wait for questions and answers.
Very helpful platform. Thank you very much indeed. And to time. May I now call on Fazana Sheikh, if you would follow that. Yes.
Thank you. Well, that was entirely comprehensive and detailed. What I want to do is to try and sound a little more provocative, if only to challenge the reputation that us experts and academics have of being rather dull. So I'm going to start off by saying that when I looked at this title, Is Pakistan the World's Most Dangerous Place?, it occurred to me that danger, like beauty, is very much in the eye of the beholder. And however hard we try to establish its objective basis, ultimately, I think, our capacity to resist the force of danger stems very much from our subjective perceptions of the threat it poses. So while, of course, today we hear about nuclear-armed, Taliban-tolerant Pakistan, saddled with this unenviable reputation as the world's most dangerous place the perception inside Pakistan, which I visit frequently, where I still have my home and my family, could not be more different. This is, of course, not to say that there is no perception of danger in Pakistan. There is. What I want to say here is rather that the sources of that danger vary sharply from those that preoccupy Pakistan's friends and enemies abroad. For it is the case that for many Pakistanis, the notion of danger is above all externally rather than internally generated, and that still remains the case. That external threat is historically and is inextricably linked to India. For in the minds of many Pakistanis, India's perceived reluctance to have come to terms with the creation of Pakistan in 1947 still translates, without question, I think, as proof of India's perceived objective to dismember the country. This perception of danger as external rather than internal, I believe, has shown no real signs of abating. And although we have heard in the last few weeks that there has been a shift in public opinion suggesting that many more people today appreciate the threat posed by militant groups inside Pakistan said to be concerned with seizing power, I do believe that this shift is still to take place, and I do believe that it is exaggerated. I would argue, on the contrary, that since September 2001, Pakistan's perceptions of the threat posed by external dangers have intensified rather than diminished, though the complexion of that threat is now as much American as Indian. America's perceived reluctance to come to terms with Pakistan's nuclear status suggests for many inside Pakistan evidence of America's perceived determination to defang the country by, quote, manufacturing a climate of danger such as to justify seizing Pakistan's nuclear assets or gaining control over them. So while the international community raises the specter of Muslim radicals seizing power in Pakistan and getting their hands on its nuclear weapons, and worse, possibly even handing them over to Al-Qaeda, Pakistan's army, I think, is still very largely persuaded that the Taliban really are no more than a manageable nuisance, a ragtag bunch of disparate warlords, we've been told, who can easily be pulverized with decisive action. Something that I think most senior Pakistani military commanders would hardly be expected confidently to predict in the event of an attack from India. That would almost certainly be construed as a fight to the death. No less apocalyptic for Pakistan would be a US military invasion. Ground troops in Pakistan, aimed at securing some or all of the country's nuclear arsenal. That would indeed, I believe, at a stroke, transform Pakistan into the world's most dangerous place, possibly even inducing some in this extremely disgruntled military today to toy with the idea of handing over Pakistan's nuclear weapons to extremist cells for safekeeping. I'm only joking, of course. So what is it that makes Pakistan appear as the most dangerous place in the world? I would suggest that this has much to do with a long-standing policy of brinkmanship, carefully honed by successive military regimes and now avidly espoused by Pakistan's political classes, who have come to understand that one way in which they can ensure their political survival is by negotiating or appearing to negotiate on behalf of Pakistan with a gun held to its head. In short, we in Pakistan, I believe, and our governing elite have come to understand that nothing pays quite like pawing at the precipice. I'll rest my case there and take questions later.
Thank you very much. Taking the argument perspective that much forward, Master Hillary, if you would.
Well, thanks very much. Let me just maybe move on from Fasana's proposition of brinkmanship and suggest that it seems to be working, this tactic. I should actually first of all say, in view of the chairman's introduction, that I'm absolutely not speaking on behalf of the British government. Indeed, I think I know more about the Pakistani government's position on this than the British. So I'm speaking personally. There are a lot of people recently who seem to have answered the question which we've been posed. The latest, as far as I can see, is a Canadian foreign minister who has declared quite simply Pakistan is the world's most dangerous place. I was more surprised by Admiral Mullen, the head of the US Armed Forces, who was reported in the Times just last week as saying Pakistan is moving closer to the tipping point, whatever that may mean. The army risks being overrun by Islamists. Hillary Clinton said Pakistan was a mortal threat to the security of the world. Gordon Brown described it as a crucible for global terrorism. I mean, what lies behind that? What lies behind it and what's the truth of it? What lies behind it, I think there are four factors. One is the spectre of nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists. The other is the possibility, the prospect that Afghanistan and Pakistan will continue to be a haven for terrorists who threaten our security. The third is the possibility of a war with India involving nuclear weapons, a possibility which certainly many of us took very seriously in 2001 and 2002. And the fourth, and these are interrelated really, the fourth specter is of a Taliban takeover of Pakistan. Now, to what extent are these feasible? I would suggest that these remarks that I've described are hyperbolic. I certainly hope that Admiral Mullen doesn't believe what he said, that the army risks being overrun by Islamists and Pakistan is moving closer to the tipping point. Why do I hope that? Because if he really does believe that, my humble judgment is that I think it rests on faulty analysis. I don't think that's true. So why are these things being said? Well, most of those statements were being said just the week before President Zardari went to Washington. Where quite clearly he was did ask for a great deal of money, unconditionally spent on Pakistan, as has been the case really since 9/11. And the Americans have learnt that it doesn't do to just give carte blanche or money freely like that. And they wanted a lot more action from Pakistan. And indeed, I think it's no coincidence that within hours of a press conference between Zardari and Obama, the Pakistan Prime Minister announced a major military offensive into Swat, where, of course, the current trouble is. Though it should be borne in mind that there have been major military offensives going on in other parts of the tribal regions for some time. The Pakistani military have lost, estimates vary between 1,500 and 2,000 people, helping us with our military interests in the west of their country. They've actually taken almost certainly more casualties than the whole of ISAF in Afghanistan since the Afghan operation started in October 2001. So it's not as if they haven't been doing much, but clearly they haven't been doing enough to fulfill our objectives. So a great deal of pressure there. Let's just look at it a little bit more closely. Nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists, tipping point and so on. My feeling is that this is very difficult to prove, but my feeling is that the army remains a highly organized institution, indeed really the only, for all its faults, the only really viable institution in Pakistan, and that if the army's interests are threatened, and secondly, if the nation's interests are threatened, then the army will eventually do something about it. And that's what we're doing in Swat. It's interesting now that just a couple of days ago, the army spokesman, General Abbas, said, you know, we must do this, we are going to do this, and we are going to eliminate all these bad guys, numbered about 5,000, using 150,000 troops to do it. Just a few months ago, he was on record as saying, we favour this peace deal in Swat, how can we run military operations when the people are against us? So there's been a volte-face. Why? Because the Pakistan Taliban were looking very nasty indeed. The Swat agreement was clearly a humiliation, and there was a lot of pressure from outside. Just touching briefly on the nuclear, I mean, following from that, if the army is still an effective institution, there are really four arms of the forces in Pakistan: Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Strategic Plans Division, which runs nuclear material. Now, American commentators are complaining that they don't know where Pakistan nuclear weapons are. Well, of course they don't. I mean, what country is going to tell anybody where their nuclear weapons are? It's very difficult to be definitive about this. But the Strategic Plans Division I've met General Kidwai a few times, who runs it, is, I think, a pretty competent outfit. It has its own intelligence organisations, apart from ISI and military intelligence, who are responsible for monitoring the psychology of operators, threats to nuclear assets, and so on. This is not authoritative, that there's been quite a lot of cooperation between the United States and Pakistan about nuclear safety and security. So I think this is a bit overdrawn, but it is true, as has been suggested, the government of Pakistan is chronically weak, and the president of Pakistan is even weaker, deeply unpopular not only in the country but with his own party. It's very difficult to know how he'll last, except for the fact that his constitutional position is very strong. I'm going to finish in just a minute and a half or so, just to offer some thoughts about what we should do about this, if anything. The first thing I want to say is there is no easy solution to this problem. There isn't suddenly some shift of policy or resources which we could devote to Pakistan which will suddenly make the thing better. I think there is one quick fix, and that is we should really stop, when I say we, I use it collectively, stop making some really gross mistakes which had been made in the past. I think the biggest one, I would say, was boots on the ground in the tribal area, American Special Forces, of September 2008. And I draw a distinction between that and the use of drones. Although, since the drones haven't actually produced many really high-value targets, I think that their value for money, strategic impact, negative, against tactical impact, positive. I think the balance has now fallen against them. So we shouldn't make mistakes. Another mistake, when Prime Minister Ghalani was forming his cabinet in early last year, in the spring of last year, I happened to be in Pakistan, suddenly arrived from a plane with no notice Deputy Secretary of State Negroponte. I don't know what his purpose was there, but it was no question but Pakistan interpreted it, rightly or wrongly, as being an effort to influence the nature of Pakistan's cabinet, bullying. That should stop. No quick fix, but what should change? I think the biggest change should be a rebalancing of assistance, not away from military assistance, that would be politically naive to suggest that, but more towards the civilian sector. Of the $11.2 billion in aid since 9/11, about two or three have gone to the civilian sector, normally in the form of budget support. At least that sum of money should go over the long term in Pakistan. Obama hopes to give precisely that $7.5 billion over the next 5 years. But the next difficulty is, how on earth do you spend that sort of money in a country where the institutions are chronically weak? It hasn't got the absorptive capacity. The trick will be to try and improve that which means a lot of human and intellectual resources to try and solve those problems. Thank you, Chair.
Well, Anu.
Can I, on your behalf and my behalf, congratulate the Forum for bringing together such a remarkable series of three speakers with very different perspectives, and also to congratulate them on keeping to time, which is the great problem of those who are chairing. May I now call, to follow the good example in terms of time, may I call on the Deputy High Commissioner to comment, please,
and should make I be facing you or the crowd?
We'd be very happy to see your back in the best
way. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. It was really provocative, I must admit. But at the same time, let me begin with my brief remarks regarding the weakness of the government. Its perception. Pakistan seems to be a dangerous place because of the perception, because of the advisories issued by our friends. And when you issue the advisory, it creates a vicious cycle. When you create advisory to the British and American nationals not to go to Pakistan, so it stops, it hampers investments. When investments are not there, it means you lose jobs. When you lose jobs, it means you spare more disgruntled people to be part of that disgruntled lot, which ultimately is going to be the part of extremism. It is a broad stroke. I am there to explain it further. Secondly, when we talk about, as Baroness pointed out, 19% popularity, these statistics are sometimes misleading in a sense that when there is a government, allow the government to complete its tenure. No one asks in Britain or in the United States when President Bush's popularity was rock bottom, but no one asked him to move. Here in Pakistan, when we talk about the popularity of a government, so it means we are hurting the institutions, which are weak. Everyone admits, the reason being that our friends have been supporting the dictatorships because of their own national interests. So no one at that point of time, because whether it was Zia-ul-Haq or Musharraf, they became darlings. After the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, Zia-ul-Haq became the darling, and Musharraf became the darling after 9/11. So we are all to blame. Then, more importantly, when you talk about Pakistan or the problem of Taliban, so you discovered the world in our part of the world after 9/11. But Pakistan's 9/11 started with the Soviet advancement, with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan 30 years ago. And since then, we are facing the refugee problem, we are facing the drug problem, we are facing the other destructions, socio-economic destructions, which have been carried out in Pakistan. So the question is, we are told that that was then, but for us, that is still a reality. That is still a problem. That is still, because in our part of the world, people more live in history. We may have joined the 21st century, but the tribal area, when we talk about, they still live in the 19th century. They don't see in gray, they don't see the gray areas. They see in black and white. They consider you either a friend or an enemy. They tell us that it was the government of Pakistan which took the U-turn after the 9/11. We are the same Mujahideen who were paid by our international friends. They point out the madrasas which were funded by our Western friends. And those madrasas are still there. And we are, when we talk about the tribal areas, we don't understand actually the tribal system, with more than 1,100 Pashtun tribes, with peculiar characteristics. But of course, there's a common code of Pashtunwali. And then when we talk about Pakistan-Afghanistan border, it is basically the divided tribes, and then rest when they appeal to the Pashtunwali code. Then that's how they come to each other's rescue. So here, since the time constraint is there, but I wanted to say, when we talk about Pakistan, institutions are working, bureaucracy is working. Military is working. The question is, basic facilities are being given to the people. Of course, there is much to be desired because of the resource crunch. Not a single day a school has been closed in any part of Pakistan, yes, except where the schools were attacked. And when those schools were restored, the education started. Now, let me come to this IDP's problem, which we are facing. Now, these are the problems not of Pakistan's creation. We did not invite the Soviet Union to attack Afghanistan. We became rather the part of this strategy of our friends, that this Mujahideen title was given none else but our friends from the West. Because at that point of time it was pointed out that it sells very hot. The religion sells very hot. So they learned. Now if we have created the monsters, so it is breeding, and it is breeding very fast. Now we have to have an exit strategy. And that exit strategy is not a short-term strategy. It is a long haul. We should be prepared for that. Because it should not be run based on one American presidency to another American presidency and with a span of 4 years. It has to be a long-term strategy. When we talk about institutions, institutions are to be strengthened. What we do? The question is, we are living, it is fine if today we say we are not cooperating. Pakistan would be peaceful. Do we agree on that? But there are many issues. The issues are we have to face. For instance, Afghanistan has become a narco state. 93% of the opium is produced there. When 93% of opium is produced there, Colombia is fighting for the last 4 decades to grapple with the problem. Just pick up this opium strategy. And when you talk about opium strategy, there's no strategy whatsoever. It does not figure in NATO's strategy to fight it, while it pours into Taliban's coffers almost $400 million at the rate of 10%, while it fetches $4 billion into Afghan black economy. Now, this $400 million for a ragtag army is more than enough. This is despite the fact, and while they also control major highways. Kabul to Kandahar. I have just returned from Kabul after 3.5 years of stay. From earlier till 2006, the transportation rate from Kabul to Kandahar was $4,000 for a 40-feet container. Now it is $10,000. The $6,000 is paid on different checkposts to the Taliban. Now with this kind of an approach, when Afghanistan has not been controlled and narcotics is still feeding into Taliban, how we can expect? And now no one talks about that, how the Taliban are getting new weapons. From where are they getting the state-of-the-art communication system? These are not Soviet-era weapons. We would like to know from where they are getting. 2,452 kilometer border between Pakistan and Afghanistan is porous, and any one of you who has traveled to that region, at least I come from that region, there are 351 such passes where you cannot post your people, otherwise each post costs you $1 million per annum. This traditionally we had never monitored in our history, and we inherited it from the Great Britain. These tribal areas, when we talk about that the rate of the government of Pakistan does not extend to the tribal areas, we inherited this from the British. Federally administered tribal areas, where political agent was appointed. And this political agent was actually the main force to run the agency, and till 9/11 it was running very well. But the reason was that we have discovered Pakistan and its tribal areas now. We talk about the human rights violations about it, ignoring the fact that it's a patriotic society, and it will remain a patriotic society for another 50 years if the current conditions are there and people are down by economy and all that. I'll leave it here, and I leave it to you. I'm open to questions. Thank you very much.